Good evening and welcome to the first of the school centenary lectures and to the first of three lectures which are going to be on the development of international peacekeeping. It's both an interesting and fortunate coincidence that the 50th anniversary of the foundation of the United Nations takes place in the same year as the 100th anniversary of the foundation of the LSE. But I think it's more than coincidence that these lectures on the development of peacekeeping are being given in this institution, because both in the Department of Law and also in the Department of International Relations, the work of the United Nations has been central both to teaching and also to research. And I think in the case of research, let me mention in the Law Department the work of Professor Roslyn Higgins, and in the case of the International Relations Department, among others, the work of Professor Jeffrey Goodwin, before he left to go to Kiel, the work of Professor Alan James, and currently the work of other people in the department, including Dr. Paul Taylor. And as a piece of advanced publicity, let me mention a volume on United Nations peacekeeping, looking at three case studies, being edited by Professor James Mayo, which is intended to publish before the end of this year. Now, our speaker this evening, Dr. Cedric Thornbury, was a colleague within the Law Department, and indeed he spent 17 years teaching at this school, pioneering the study of human rights, in part with reference to the UN. He joined the United Nations in 1978 and has been an employee of that organization until most recently. He's been involved in peacekeeping operations in Cyprus, in the Middle East, in Namibia, and in former Yugoslavia. And he concluded his career as Deputy Chief of Mission for UNPROFOR with the rank of Assistant Secretary General. And in recognition of his distinguished career, the school conferred on him the status of Honorary Fellow in 1993. And so we have someone who's going to speak to us this evening with rich experience of international peacekeeping, and I call on Dr. Cedric Thornbury to talk to us this evening about that subject.
Mr. Co-Director, Mr. Chairman, it's a pleasant and evocative thing to return to one's alma mater, even if in this case her role was strictly adoptive. For LSE was, for me, enormously stimulative and supportive to me when I first came here as a young lawyer from somewhere else. It gave me the generous encouragement and creative atmosphere in which to pursue my interests in both humanitarian and international fields, and as you were kind enough to mention, to establish here nearly 25 years ago, I'm sorry to say, courses in the then incipient international law of human rights. At a time when such an interest, I seem to recall, was widely regarded as being more or less irrefutable proof of acute eccentricity. The splendid traditions of this school in the humanitarian field are, of course, associated with such great lawyers as Sir Hersch Lauterpacht, Sir Robert Jennings, Sir Otto Kahn-Freund, and many others. They're eminently followed now today by Professor Roslyn Higgins, who, if I may dare say so, was perhaps like me at one time a little bit of an intellectual refugee from that other place. When I left the school in 1978 at the invitation of the United Nations, it was supposed to have been for only a month or two to help the UN planning its then imminently expected Namibia operation. It didn't quite work out like that, and I now feel it an immense honor to have been invited at the initiative of the International Relations Department to open this year's series of centenary lectures and to speak also in the context of the United Nations attainment this year of its 50th anniversary. My first lecture this evening I have subtitled From Jerusalem to Windhoek. My own entree to peacekeeping, therefore, lay through my background in the teaching here at LSE and the practice of the international law of human rights. There is a close connection between the advancement of human rights and the promotion of peacekeeping in several contexts. First of all, peacekeeping is a mechanism, a phrase which I'm afraid you're going to hear me say quite frequently, a mechanism which helps to create conditions in which humanitarian, human rights, and democratic values may have a chance to develop. Second, the peacemaking process, which ought to accompany it, should address the roots of crises, not merely their symptoms, and these roots often have a human rights basis. Third, it's important that UN peacekeeping operations keep the humanitarian imperative in clear focus if they are to retain their legitimacy, effectiveness, public support, and future potential for growth. In my opinion, failure by the United Nations to confront massive breaches of human rights, though sometimes explicable, could in the long term erode some of the basic assumptions of our society and the humanitarian standards which the UN has itself played a major part in establishing in its first 50 years. This universal standard setting perhaps being, together with the creation of international peacekeeping, one of the UN's most significant achievements. And yet, as I shall stress, the UN can rarely be more, even today, than the sum of its parts. And whatever the International Court may have said in 1949 in the reparation for injuries case, itself deriving from a background in the earliest peacekeeping, the UN remains at this time basically still a center for the harmonization of the actions of its members. But I am jumping way ahead of myself. On these three evenings, I shall first, under tonight's title of From Jerusalem to Windhoek, set out to look at the development of UN peacekeeping operations during their first 41 years. From the establishment of UNTSO, the UN Truce Supervision Organization in Jerusalem and in Palestine in 1948, to final preparations in 1989 to emplace UNTAG in Namibia, thereby bringing an end to one of the longest disputes engaging the whole international community. In my second lecture on Thursday evening, I shall focus almost entirely on two of the major recent operations of the United Nations, namely Namibia from 1989 to 90, and then from Yugoslavia from 1992 onwards. While in many respects dissimilar, and though each is particular to its facts, closer analysis helps, I think, to highlight some of the factors which recur and which are significant to the future development of peacekeeping. In honor of the mordant humor of its inhabitants, and recalling a dictum that reflected at least the atmosphere of the time, I've entitled this second lecture, Only the Odd-Numbered World Wars Start in Sarajevo. Finally, next Monday, under the caption, Peacekeeping in the 90s and Beyond, I shall try to identify some of the steps that need to be taken in order to strengthen peacekeeping, some of the flaws that have emerged, and do this in the context of developing international institutions and the kinds of underlying issue with which we are now and are likely to continue to be confronted. But I shall not attempt a comprehensive history of the subject. A number of admirable treatments have appeared in recent years. I have mentioned Professor Rosalind Higgins, and I should also mention the insightful accounts and analyses of two other of our former colleagues, Professors Alan James and Adam Roberts, to to both of whom I'm indebted for many of their perceptions. One of the major drawbacks of practicing peacekeeping is that, especially in recent years, which have been marked by a pandemonium of activity, one has little time to read anything other than official cables and the hurly-burly of operational traffic, while trying to ensure that actions and decisions are, at the very least, tenable. While, therefore, in recent months I have had a chance to reflect on what we have been doing in the last years, my contribution, I have to say, will still essentially be that of the practitioner. It will certainly express no more than a personal and rather selective viewpoint. However, I have been privileged to have participated as head of the political sides of missions which cover a fairly representative group of the operations set up during the 46 years of peacekeeping, UNTSO in the Middle East from 1982 to 84, and UNTSO was, as I mentioned, the earliest UN operation, then UNTAG, the UN Transition Assistance Group in Namibia from 1989 to 90, headed, of course, by now President Martti Ahtisaari of Finland, and UNPROFOR in ex-Yugoslavia from its start-up until last year, as well as UNFISIP in Cyprus in the early 80s. I was also somewhat surprised to find myself director of the UN's Office of Administration and Management in the Secretariat in New York for four absorbing and disturbing years in the late 80s. The UN Charter shows that the primary concern of its draftsmen was with the maintenance of international peace and security, and in this regard with the establishment of mechanisms whereby collective measures could be undertaken to prevent and remove international threats to the peace, as well as with ensuring that disputes or situations which could threaten peace would be peacefully and justly resolved. The Charter also emphasizes human rights, the equality of nations, the maintenance of the international rule of law, and international cooperation in solving problems of an economic, social, cultural, or humanitarian nature. But the underlying preoccupation is, in my view, rightly, with the maintenance of international peace and security, and the perception is that such threats may come from interstate disputes, and armed force was to be used only in the common interest. While the Charter was proclaimed in the name of the peoples of the United Nations, it is in fact firmly founded upon the existing system of sovereign states. Little attention is paid by it to events which lie behind the veil of sovereignty, and the first part of Article 2, Paragraph 7 emphasizes that nothing contained in the present Charter shall authorize the UN to intervene in matters which are essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state, or shall require the members to submit such matters to settlement under the present Charter. Yet the second part of the article makes it clear that events or situations which would otherwise be outside the competence of the UN could move within it in the event of a determination by the Security Council that such constituted a threat to the peace or breach of the peace or act of aggression. As later history has shown, in instances such as South African apartheid, situations involving gross breaches of human rights may slip away from a domestic exclusivity of jurisdiction to an international forum. Well before the deluge of recent years, several of the UN's early peacekeeping ventures related to situations within the confines of states and arising between contending parties of the same nationality, with DOMREP in 1965 to 60, mission of the representative of the Secretary General in the Dominican Republic, with ONUC in the Congo from 1960 to 64, with UNSF, the United Nations Security Force, in 62 to 63, the force in West Irian, and of course with UNFISIP, the United Nations Force in Cyprus, from 1964 to date. In only one of these, ONUC was Chapter 7 invoked. Each such operation has raised delicate issues, with many members reluctant to establish precedents. I should recall that even in 1992, at the time of UNPROFOR's initial deployment into ex-Yugoslavia, some states continued to feel reluctance to be associated with a UN presence deployed in such a particular political context. The issue arose in the context of military contingents and indeed in connection with the secondment of senior officers. Thus, while the system of collective security contemplated by the Charter was formulated almost entirely in the context of interstate problems, the organization has, during its history, developed a discrete capability in the field of intercommunal or other intrastate situations. Meanwhile, since the Charter, internal conflicts have greatly outnumbered interstate, though many of the internal have had international dimensions. The prevalence of civil wars is even more marked today. In 1993, it has been calculated, 34 conflicts were taking place in different parts of the world. All were internal. The UN's experience in the Congo from 1960 to 64, when it took more fatal casualties than in any other peace operation before or since, even more than Yugoslavia, saw deep divisions develop among its members, suffered the tragic loss of its Secretary General, and emerged practically bankrupt, created a deep trauma in the UN's collective consciousness. This was still strong in the late 70s when the Namibian mission was first contemplated. The institutional memory of the House was troubled by the possibility of being sucked into a Southern African maelstrom with divided peoples incited by external interests, the UN caught in the middle, and of course scapegoated by all. Meanwhile, the classical peacekeeping operation had developed principally in the Middle East, though Articles 39, 41, and 42, providing the core of the system of collective security envisaged by the Charter, create ample scope for evaluations of potential threats to the peace and for decisions on appropriate action, the mechanisms presupposed cooperation among the permanent members of the Council. This, even under the best of circumstances, would have been hard to maintain in all instances. In the Cold War environment, it was impossible. As the Blue Helmets, the official account by the United Nations of its peacekeeping operations puts it, new conflicts arose, particularly during the process of decolonization, and many could not be resolved by peaceful means. A way had to be found to stop hostilities and to control conflicts so that they would not develop into broader conflagrations. Out of that need, UN peacekeeping operations evolved as essentially holding actions. There was not, and still is not, any particular theory or doctrine behind them. They were born of necessity, largely improvised, a practical response to a problem requiring action. The term peacekeeping operation did not gain currency until much later. I would add a footnote to the distinguished author of the Blue Helmets note here to say that I think that a philosophy and principles and rules have subsequently emerged in regard to peacekeeping, but I will come to that later and to what I think is its importance. The conflict between Jews and Arabs, which broke out in Palestine in 1948 with the ending of the British Mandate and the failure of the UN-approved partition plan, led to the creation of the UN's first peacekeeping operation, UNTSO, the UN Truce Supervision Organization. Its initial role, and there have been very many other mandates since then, was to assist the then UN mediator in supervising the truce between the warring parties called for by the Security Council. The mediator, Count Volker Bernadotte, was murdered in Jerusalem in September 1948 by an Israeli gang. Ralph Bunche took over as acting mediator. The UN military observers, since known throughout the world as UNMOs and who are unarmed, remained in the area after, in the following year, armistice agreements were concluded between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Until today, the UNMOs have been deployed throughout the region with functions which have tended to change with the outcome of the various Arab-Israeli wars. In general terms, their tasks were to provide channels of communication between the contending forces, to contain the inevitable range of incidents, and to ensure that the Security Council and Secretary General had a steady flow of authentic and objective information as to events in the Middle East, which for long threatened to be the world's most explosive region. They have had two other significant major functions: to provide a military observer presence to assist the other two peacekeeping operations in the region, UNIFIL, the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, established in 1978, and UNDOF, the UN Disengagement Observer Force, which is on the Golan Heights between Syria and Israel, in 1974, and to provide support in terms both of planning and of personnel for other missions as they started up in various parts of the world, including the two later United Nations Emergency Force, UNEF, operations. The major powers have, in fact, participated in UNSO. After 1990, when the Chinese sent some military observers, only the UK of the five permanent members is not represented among the United Nations military observers. The mission is based in Jerusalem in what used to be no man's land between Arab and Israeli lines in the former British government house set atop the Hill of Evil Counsel, as Amos Oz, the Israeli novelist, insists. In fact, as I was political advisor to UNSO, Amos Oz used to insist that I was actually the evil counselor myself. My time in the area began just after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and coincided with the Sabra Shatila massacres in Beirut. Much of the next 2 years was spent in Beirut, where the UN had a small group of 50 UNMOs patrolling unarmed and almost entirely unmolested in soft-skinned vehicles in a city which was in an advanced and brutal stage of self-destruction. This also gave ample opportunity to observe the role of the Western multinational force, actually MNF2, and its even more rapid and tragic path to self-destruction. It should have been, and one had hoped, having seen it, that it would have been an object lesson in what a peacekeeping mission should not do, a lesson which one would have hoped would not have had to be learnt more than once. One would have been disappointed. UNSO provided support and initial personnel to each of the other peacekeeping operations established in the Middle East. Its pioneering experience and unequaled institutional knowledge of the region were important to the UN's first peacekeeping force, UNEF-1, United Nations Emergency Force, established in 1956 after the Suez operation. By this time, experience of peacekeeping enabled the General Assembly to endorse for the Secretary General Hammarskjöld, for the first time, a set of guidelines for the conduct and operation of the force, dealing with the status of the commander, the mandate, deployment on the basis of the party's consent, the status of the force in terms of local laws, its use of force, financing, impartiality, composition, and other fundamentals. UNEF's general success, controversial perhaps only in the circumstances of its withdrawal in 1967, provided encouragement for a series of other operations which saw UN peacekeeping develop into new functional areas. With UNOGIL in Lebanon, the observer force down in southern Lebanon, DOMREP, the operation in the Dominican Republic, and UNIPOM on the Indo-Pakistan border. Though some of these missions had mixed success, and ONUC in the Congo almost destroyed the UN, commentators agree that by the mid-60s, the foundations of UN peacekeeping had been laid. Tacit agreement, as Sally Morfitt notes in her admirable brief summary of UN peacekeeping and election monitoring in the book which was edited by Kingsbury and Roberts, had been reached on a number of guiding principles: the role of the Secretary General, the agreed mandate need, consent of the host states, impartiality, so that participants could contribute to the management of the problem rather than risk becoming a part of it, the non-use of force save in self-defense, question of composition, and the need for creative flexibility in conceptualizing a peacekeeping presence, so that the needs of the situation could be dealt with using the most appropriate means. So we can say that by the mid to late 60s, there had been widespread agreement on the basic structures of a peacekeeping operation and the basic elements of the conception of peacekeeping. The 70s saw the establishment of UNEF II and often UNIFIL in the Middle East. UNEF established in 1974 to oversee the ceasefire, bringing the 73 Israeli-Egyptian war to an end, was wound up in 1979, having fulfilled its mandate, and in the controversial atmosphere which followed on the Camp David agreements. UNDOF on the Golan and UNIFIL in South Lebanon are, of course, still in place. The Golan operation of UNDOF having probably been one of the UN's most successful operations. Both parties, Israel and Syria, having from the outset resolved to ensure such success and having extended full cooperation. It is a rather ironic thing that one of the matters under discussion in the current Middle East talks is the replacement of UNDOF by a different kind of force. UNIFIL in South Lebanon since 1978 has had a very, very difficult mandate and only limited cooperation from the parties, any of the parties. In 1982, another non-UN force, MFO, the Multinational Force and Observers, was established in the Sinai after Israeli withdrawal. So by the early 80s, only five missions, all of relatively long standing, were in the field. The two observer missions in the Middle East and Kashmir, UNTSU and UNMUGIP, and UNDOF, UNIFIL, and UNFISIP in the Middle East and Cyprus. UNTAG was established, the UN Transition Assistance Group for Namibia, was established by the Security Council in 1978 and remained in suspended animation as the South Africans delayed its implementation, the implementation of the Namibian Peace Agreement. UNDOF continued through the determined cooperation of the parties successfully to carry out its mandate, its tranquility marred only by the occasional adventurous shepherd. But UNIFIL's problems seemed never-ending, with kaleidoscopic changes in Lebanon, Beirut, and elsewhere in Lebanon, and frequent crises between elements in southern Lebanon and Israel. Yet through most of the conflict which afflicted the rest of the country, the UNIFIL area of operation remained comparatively stable, and many Lebanese fled from their own neighborhoods, not only in Beirut, but even to the north of Beirut, to enjoy the comparative peace and economic stability which existed in a band south of the Litani River, coinciding with the UNIFIL region. But UN peacekeeping itself had apparently reached a plateau. Though the attitudes of Russia and China had become perceptibly more benign at the end of the 70s and early 80s, the attitude of the US had in turn cooled. The US, by the early 80s, was withholding financial contributions. And not only peacekeeping, but the United Nations itself was once again in a most difficult situation. Many governments were not paying their bills, either on time or even at all. Regularly, as I vividly remember, the senior members of the Department of Administration and Management of the United Nations met with Undersecretary Akhtisari to discuss whether the UN could meet its immediate commitments. And on more than one Friday morning in Akhtisari's office, the agenda had only one item: whether the Undersecretary had the obligation now to go to the Secretary General and advise him that he should close the building that afternoon because we were no longer able to pay the bills. On every such occasion, the means was found somehow to tide the organization over the week, or sometimes two, until one or another expected contribution would arrive at the bank. It was a knife-edge time for the UN, and some believed, and may still believe, that it was not in its interest to continue trying to do it with mirrors. No one was happy that we had to borrow from other special accounts to meet the payroll or the utilities bills because of cavalier attitudes by many governments to their responsibilities to the UN. There is no question but that the rules of strict accountancy, had they been applied at that time in regard to the various funds, would certainly have dictated closure. But we just avoided it, though the UN was not viable and owed huge sums to, amongst others, troop contributors, which it could not pay. As I say, there is still perhaps a feeling, and it may come to the surface once again in the not too distant future, there is still a feeling that a temporary closure might have been the only remaining effective way to concentrate the minds of the defaulters. Certainly the situation was deeply debilitating, and when new missions began to come to the UN in the latter part of the 80s, the cupboard was completely bare. There were no financial reserves which could be used to float a mission until fresh appropriations could begin to come through the system. Nor was there any reserve equipment at the UN storage depot in Pisa. We could not, in one or two instances, even supply some new missions with UN flags or blue helmets until they had been some weeks in the field. On more than one occasion, the Under Secretary General and even the Secretary General had to call in the ambassadors, essentially of the permanent five, and tell them that there would be no more expenditure on some new peacemaking project they had proposed unless and until they were able to come with ready cash. A substantial cash deposit was required before we would commit the UN to any further action. Not even the Secretary General of the United Nations can make gold from straw. Possibly not even the conflicts and tribulations of the UN in the Congo period matched the financial, administrative, and operational problems of the mid-80s. Perhaps this was the nadir for the United Nations. It cannot be said too often or too clearly that the first obligation of member states of the UN is to pay their bills in full and on time. If they do not do so, then the rest of what we discuss in looking at the role of the UN and at the aspirations of the Charter is relevant only in the realms of the most abstruse and unrealistic theory. Nor has the situation greatly improved nearly 10 years later. The United Nations had to postpone meeting the payroll only last month, again because contributions were not coming forward from governments which were legally obligated to produce those sums. And reimbursement to troop contributors is again falling seriously into arrears. The exquisite dilemma which we were facing at that time was that even as the financial pressure became almost intolerable upon the United Nations, so we knew that the ice was beginning to crack. The Secretariat was being tantalized by increasing signs of change in the international atmosphere. While peacekeeping as such was just jogging along, indications were being received that the Soviet Union was looking for a new relationship with the UN and with the whole realm of peacekeeping and peacemaking. From as early as 1983 to 84, approaches were being made to senior UN staff members by some USSR diplomats in the field, indicating that their authorities were reconsidering their role in many parts of the world. Former British permanent representative to the UN, Sir Anthony Parsons, has also described this trend at this time, though he concluded that, quote, even before the Gorbachev era, the UN had become the focal point for demonstrating to the Kremlin that military adventurism had its political cost to Soviet interests. Then Secretary General Pérez de Cuellar, by 1984, had sensed the direction of the wind and had begun to develop a more active role for his office, using his good office's functions under Chapter 15 of the Charter in exploring the possibilities for peacemaking as distinct from peacekeeping, which was dealt with 80 yards further down the corridor to the south on the 38th floor. During this time also, United States Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Chet Crocker, who had largely taken over the becalmed negotiations for a Namibian and indeed general Southern African settlement, began detecting new flexibilities among the various parties, and a fresh momentum began slowly to develop, with the UN Secretary General and his special representative increasingly engaged. The search for peace in Namibia from the late 70s onwards was a very interesting, perhaps indeed a unique, process in which first the Western Contact Group, then the frontline states, then the Secretary General and his special representative, then one or more of these various negotiators would move into the driving seat, would take the initiative for a critical period or process until returning responsibility to the group. But the first overt signs of the disintegration of the ice flows came in 87, when the five permanent members jointly drafted a mandatory resolution, SCR 598, on the Iran-Iraq war. This eventually formed the basis for a ceasefire in 1988 and the deployment of UNIMOG to monitor the ceasefire. A little earlier that year, UNGOMAP, a small mission staffed entirely by redeployments from UNSO, UNDOF, and UNIFIL, was deployed to assist in an Afghan settlement, which permitted the long-desired withdrawal of Soviet troops. This was the first new peacekeeping mission since UNIFIL 10 years earlier. That year also saw the Soviet Union begin to pay arrearages on its unpaid peacekeeping contributions. The speed of events began to accelerate in 88 to 89, and it was a very exciting time to be in New York. In September 1988, Pérez de Cuellar visited South Africa to discuss arrangements with the then South African president, P.W. Botha, for the implementation of the Namibian peace plan. By the end of 88, agreements had been signed in Brazzaville and in New York for the beginnings of a comprehensive Southern African settlement, including the implementation of the Namibian independence plan and the unofficially linked process of Cuban withdrawal from Angola. It actually fell to me in November 1988 to lead the preparatory mission of the UN to Namibia and South Africa to smooth the way for the mission's projected arrival early the following year. Returning to Southern Africa after an absence of a year or two, and in a very skeptical frame of mind, I did not really believe what I was hearing and seeing. I was astonished by the change in atmosphere. The atmosphere in the whole of Southern Africa was electric with the prospect of Namibian and indeed wider change. For nobody in the senior ranks of politics that I met in Southern Africa at that time, except perhaps President Botha, believed that Namibia would see the end of the process. On the contrary, I think Chet Crocker in his recent book on this part of the process has already disclosed that discussions in the margins of the now dynamic Angola-Namibia negotiating process were giving a great deal of food for thought, especially to some South African negotiators. I believe they felt that the game was nearly up, and they were seeking breathing space and convincing reassurances while they sought to manage, to project, and conceive a process of managed change in South Africa itself. But I don't want to overstate this, because for some years to come, the South African position was not unanimous, even during the Namibian process, but of one thing I am sure, and that is that the nature of the negotiations within what subsequently was called the Joint Commission, gave a number of the reassurances to South Africa which its negotiators subsequently said they needed in order to begin trying to move in certain directions. The first step in the Southern African settlement was to establish a small observer mission, UNIVAM 1 in Angola, and this was done in December 1988. Its task was to verify the agreed withdrawal of Cuban troops, and this was completed according to schedule in May 91. The consul's next step was to authorize the implementation, beginning the 1st of April 1989, of the peace plan for Namibia. But before taking a longer look in my second lecture at the Namibian operation and then the Yugoslav operation, I think it's appropriate to try to summarize some of the main features of the first 40 years of peacekeeping. Prior to UNTAG's deployment in April 1989, there had been 16 UN peacekeeping missions. Of these, UNTSO in the Middle East, UNMUGIP in Kashmir, UNFISIP in Cyprus, UNDOF on the Golan, UNIFIL in Lebanon, UNGOMAP in Afghanistan and Pakistan, UNIMOG in Iran, Iraq, and UNIVAM 1 in Angola were still in existence. Of the overall 16, 9 had been observer missions, the other 7 having also had infantry contingents. 2, ONUC in the Congo and the UN Security Force, UNTI in Transition Executive Authority in West New Guinea, had substantial civilian as well as security tasks. Most dealt with instabilities concomitant upon the ending of colonialism and the establishment of new states in their areas of operation. The size of the operations had ranged from nearly 20,000 in the Congo to a handful of observers in the Dominican Republic and a few hundred in most of the other observer missions. Their duration had varied from a few months to several decades. In a number of instances, mandates had been varied several times during the period of the operation. Those mandates derived from Security Council resolutions, except in the cases of UNEF 1 and the UN Security Force, while various bases of funding had been established and experimented with over the years, it had become usual by the 80s for peacekeeping to be funded through obligatory contributions by all member states according to a peacekeeping formula. All missions were based on the consent of the parties, operated according to strict rules of impartiality, and required the continuing cooperation of the parties. The use of force was limited to self-defense, though in some missions this concept was construed so as to include the use of proportional force to withstand the activities of armed personnel who sought to prevent the UN from carrying out its mandate, particularly in UNIFIL, and particularly by the battalions of certain nationalities which will be nameless. Military personnel were being provided to peacekeeping on a voluntary basis and passed under the operational command of the Secretary General. The selection of countries providing military contingents was in practice made after consultation with the parties, the council being kept informed. In each of these 16 cases, the peacekeeping mission did not provide, nor was it intended to provide, a solution to the underlying question. At best, it was a means of controlling a dangerous situation while others sought to resolve the problem. In sum, the peacemaking process, undertaken by the Secretary General, proceeded in tandem with the operation on the ground, the UN Security Force in West New Guinea being a particularly good example. In others, the best example being the operations pertaining to the Arab-Israeli disputes, the UN, for the most part, was not the main peacekeeping entity. Indeed, it is fair to say that until the mid to late 80s, the UN had for long been sidelined as a major international negotiating body, and peacekeeping itself seemed to have leveled out as countries began to experiment with the development of peacekeeping outside the framework of the United Nations. In some cases, such as Kashmir, the Middle East, and Cyprus, wherein UN operations had been in place for many years, there was no imminent prospect of substantive solution. It's sometimes less difficult to keep a ceasefire in being than to negotiate away the causes of the original conflict, as the Blue Helmets notes. This was manifestly true in the Middle East, Kashmir and Cyprus, and the consul certainly had to consider on a number of occasions whether the operation had itself become a part of the problem by, and I quote, protecting the parties from the consequences of their negotiating stance. But it should not be assumed that longevity means that a peacekeeping operation has failed. On the contrary, longevity may be a measure of its success in preventing a recurrence of hostilities or containing them in spite of the intractability of the situation. With the 17th operation, the UN Transition Assistance Group in Namibia and its successors, a qualitative change came over peacekeeping. True, UNICOM on the Iraq-Kuwait border closely resembles hitherto traditional missions. But the Central American missions, UNIVEM II in Angola, UNIMOS in Mozambique, UNTAC in Cambodia, UNPROFOR in Yugoslavia, and the hapless UNISOM in Somalia, to name some obvious examples, have had a quite different character. They are sometimes called second-generation peacekeeping, although that term seems to me to be a little bit uncomfortable for reasons that I will go into maybe next time. The phrase peace support operations has also been used to indicate their change in emphasis. But UNPROFOR in Bosnia, for example, has never had a peace to keep or support, though so far it has in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. No really satisfactory single term has yet emerged to cover the multiplicity and diversity of current operations. While most of the earlier missions had an overwhelmingly military character, and as their main objective a temporary freezing of the status quo, while others sought solutions, many of the more recent undertakings have been more ambitious. Most have had a substantial non-military element, many have been led by civilians, and the majority have been multifunctional. Thus, it has not simply been a question of them being much larger than before, with the exception of ONUC in the Congo, which remained by far the largest operation until overtaken in 1992 by UNPROFOR in ex-Yugoslavia. UNPROFOR now has 38,000 personnel. The task of the UN became more dynamic. It was not there to maintain the status quo. Its overall goal, in many instances, was itself to bring about peace or some other fundamental change in the situation. It did this usually in accordance with a plan, characteristically set out in broad terms, endorsed by the Security Council at the time of implementation. In some cases, its main role has been to provide support in situations of grave humanitarian need. But in Namibia, Angola, Mozambique, Central America, Cambodia, and Somalia, the UN was required not only to bring about peace, but also to conduct nationwide processes of reconstruction and reconciliation. Their task, in broad terms, was to harmonize or unify deeply divided nations long racked by war, and often to establish democratic societies where previously there might have been some form of tyranny or even anarchy. Therefore, although these new missions had substantial military components, with especially in Yugoslavia, Cambodia, and Somalia, substantial strengths and rather advanced tasks, they were basically missions with a specific political objective and complex mandate, with civilian, military, and police elements and functions mutually interlocking and supportive under a political leadership. The majority have been successful, too very successful. Against, I may say, the predictions of many soothsayers, some have not been so successful. On Thursday, I shall talk in detail about those in Namibia and ex-Yugoslavia. Thus, the pilot operation was UNTAG in Namibia. On the 16th of February 1989, the Security Council authorized the implementation of the more than 10-year-old peace plan contained in SCR 435 of 1978, beginning on the 1st of April 1989. That 1st of April 1989 was a Saturday, and it had been foreseen as one of great rejoicing, And indeed, in Windhoek, in any event, it began in something of a carnival atmosphere. But soon as reports began to come in, it became a blood-drenched horror. And for some, the longest day and the longest nightmare of their lives. I shall return to the Namibian experience on Thursday.
Dr. Thornby may have left the school nearly two decades ago, but it's quite clear that the culture is still there because the lecture was perfectly programmed for 50 minutes. That leaves us some time for questions. Are there any questions? Please, at the back.
Could you give a little more detail, please, about the formula under which you said compulsory peacekeeping for the community, where there is
Yes, the regular budget is appropriated among the 184, now 185 member states, according to a complex system which has to do with gross national product and population and all kinds of things that I have never really, frankly, even understood, even as director of administration. And that results in, for example, the United States paying 25%. Of the regular budget. Japan has the next highest contribution, et cetera, et cetera. The vast majority of members pay very little. I mean, they're down well below 0%. I mean, 0.something or other%. In regard to the peacekeeping formula, which was worked out some years ago, the permanent members of the Security Council would shoulder a higher percentage of the burden. And a formula was worked out, which, for example, results in the United States paying just over 30%, I think, Ross, isn't it, of the peacekeeping budget, with proportionate increases for the other permanent members. And on the whole, the less rich countries pay considerably less. This has been applied more or less, without too much fractiousness on the part of the permanent members until fairly recently. Now the United States Congress has taken the view that the U.S. contribution is much too high, both in regard to the regular budget and also in regard to the budget under a peacekeeping assessment. Now, whatever one might think of the merits of their argument, one has also to bear in mind the major problem which exists if any one country has too big a share of the budget. Not only do they have the obligation that goes with a very high budgetary share, but they also have certain possibilities, certain rights, which we experienced to the nth degree in the 80s when under the Reagan administration, Congress began withholding, and it was very difficult to get them to stop. Even when the U.S. administration wanted them to stop withholding, Congress had the bit between their teeth. So we can see an issue developing now, I would think, with the Republican majority in the U.S. Congress now. We may very well see a fairly bitter discussion going on between the United States and, in the end, the other members of the Security Council and the United Nations in regard to the size of U.S. contribution. But, of course, the U.S. cannot determine this unilaterally. I mean, that's going to be very difficult to explain to the U.S. Congress. But I mean, but this is part of a general discussion of a general agreement, which is worked out by the members of the General Assembly, in fact. Well, I brought my charter, but unfortunately I can't remember the article. Maybe somebody can tell me immediately which article it is under the of the charter under which member states oblige themselves by signature of the charter to meet their assessed contributions. One has also to bear there is a specific charter obligation which was investigated in some detail by the World Court, I think, in the 1960s. But what I was also thinking about was the change which came over the UN budgeting process in the 80s as a result of the Group of 18 program of reforms, which we were put in for our sins to try to implement in the administration of the UN. And that was, and I think it's an important change and a good change, is that the budget of the United Nations is now determined by consensus. So that the General Assembly has to endorse the budget of the United Nations unanimously, or in any event, not nem con. So there is a legal agreement. There's a political agreement. I mean, I would think there are umpteen bases of legal agreement in regard to this. The problem, as I say, is now going to come if one or more states want to unravel some of the previous consensual understandings in regard to assessment. That's going to be a real can of worms. But it's coming, and it may not be a bad thing in the end, but it's going to be very uncomfortable in the short term. If you listened to me 30 years ago and you listen to me again today, you may perceive that most of my thoughts are general. A lot of people are thirsty, you know. It's very difficult to... The short answer is yes, I have a lot of thoughts of a general kind. I believe, having experienced it, very strongly in the possibility of the development of international peacekeeping. I think that it has a number of flaws which have been fairly clearly shown in the last two or three years. And I believe that it is essential to go back to first principles in regard to what peacekeeping can and cannot do, and to be realistic about this. Above all, one has to bear in mind that whatever the desirability of a particular objective, if it requires enforcement, then we are talking about a horse of a different color. Enforcement and peacekeeping are totally different entities, and enforcement, by and large, means Desert Storm or its cousin. And when governments are willing to put up the resources for a Desert Storm, then they may, or perhaps should, speak, then they can speak responsibly about what the UN should do. But if, for example, they don't want to put up the resources, I think they should be careful about the expectations which they arouse among their electorates. And I personally believe, I'm in love with the Swedish government, all Swedish governments, because for years they have been taking the people into their confidence and talking to them about the realities. What peacekeeping will cost. How many young boys and young girls are not going to come back if we take this course of action? This is what we recommend. What do you, the people, think? It's dreadful. It's called democracy. And very subversive indeed. But I don't think that you can actually get a proper constituency for peacekeeping until you begin informing the people and engaging in a dialogue. What justification is there otherwise for young men and young women to go and die for some abstract ism 5,000 miles away in a country that most people can't even pronounce, much less find on the map? You have to create a more solid base. You did provoke me.
I think that's a very good point of junction between today's lecture and the one next, which I remind you again will take place on Thursday the 19th in this theatre at 5:30. Can I say what a great pleasure it is to have you back at the school and to have you begin to deliver these lectures, and also to express what I think will be a general view of what a masterly compression you've given us of 40 years of United Nations experience of peacekeeping. And in so doing so, you've brought to it a unique perspective, a personal one, but you've also combined it with one which you had when you were here, namely a scholarly one. Thank you very much indeed.